loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we continue our regular weekly segment called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. Today, we focus on the teacher strikes in several cities, part of a wave of women-led labor activism, as well as young women leading climate marches in the United States and in Europe. And then we continue our weekly series, it's every Tuesday, called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. 16 states so far have sued the Trump administration for declaring a national emergency over the border wall. President Trump announced the emergency on Friday, saying, quote, "I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I don't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster," unquote. The lawsuit says that the president does not have the authority to divert funds for a border wall. British Prime Minister Theresa May is meeting European Commission Chief Jean-Claude Juncker on Wednesday in Brussels to talk about the Brexit deal, although the EU has said that no further negotiations are possible. The Brexit deadline is 5 weeks away on March 29th. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn is also due to meet with the EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier later this week. U.S.-China trade talks are being held today in Washington. Higher-level talks will start later in the week and will be led by U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer. He'll be joined by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow, and Trade Advisor Peter Navarro. This week's talks follow negotiations in Beijing last week that officials say made substantial progress. Roger Stone was ordered to appear in court because of a photo he posted on social media that appeared to target the judge in his case with gun sights behind her. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson said Stone will need to prove how this behavior does not violate the gag order in his case. Stone has claimed the gun sights are a logo. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Hannah Dickinson is a professor. She is also an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson joins us from Geneva, New York, and we're joined here in studio by Nicole Roussel, a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. We're also joined by Walter Smolarek, another Sputnik News analyst. Welcome to all of you.
So, Hannah, where do you want to start today?
I think we should talk about some teacher strikes, both the exciting conclusions and possible future strikes here. And I definitely want to start with West Virginia, because West Virginia public school teachers and school service personnel are on strike today. And they're striking over a new bill that would pave the way for charter schools and private school vouchers in that state. And that's a state actually that relies primarily on public education. They don't have charters there. And so it's a really important fight against the privatization of public education in defense of public education. And we know these West Virginia teachers know how to strike.
Definitely West Virginia's strike is really important. And it was interesting to see, since they struck so recently, in reading about what's going on there. This is, you know, they're striking over what could be a huge overhaul for the educational system there. This would both funnel public money into a voucher system, which I think has long been proven to be something that obviously does not help public education. This is funneling money out of public education that needs more money, but it's taking money out of it and, you know, improving outcomes for just a few people at a time rather than improving outcomes for everyone on the whole. And this bill would, this bill has gone back and forth and there's many different versions, but there are also proposals in West Virginia that would create charter schools there as well, which is a really, it's essentially an alternative, right, to public school systems, that we should just be funding those public school systems. But instead, this is creating another system of schools, often for profit, often with a profit incentive, that we've seen in many states and many localities has completely stripped public education of funding and of support. New Orleans, for example, when after Katrina, Hurricane Katrina hit the city, the education system was rebuilt in almost all charter schools. And we've seen that completely strip the public education system of all functionality. So this is this makes total sense why they're striking. And it's really encouraging that they're standing up and they're really ready to put their jobs on the line again to push forward and try to stop this really, really regressive bill from happening. Hannah, what are you seeing going on in West Virginia? How is they're just starting today. Are you seeing what's going to happen over the coming days?
We'll see how things develop, right? But I think one thing to note about today is that all but one of the state's 55 public school systems have canceled classes today. So I think we're seeing a really united West Virginia, which is important. And I think the other thing that's really interesting is that, you know, they've said the strike is indefinite and that they'll be keeping an eye on what's going on in the state house and Senate. And so I think that's a really important flexing of teacher and school personnel power, right? To say we will withhold our labor and force the state governments to make some, or legislative bodies, right, to make some decisions here rather than this really strange kind of hot potato they've been playing around the future of public education in West Virginia. So I think those are things to sort of keep an eye on. And I would just add that now West Virginia teachers have been involved in a struggle both for their own pay and their own livelihood and in defense of, and now here in this forum in defense of public education, right after a wildcat strike last year, the sort of terrain of what organized labor looks like in the teaching professions is shifting really rapidly in really exciting ways, as teachers say, yeah, it's not just your standard fight back. We think it's our jobs to defend public education, you know, by stopping work. I think it's an important trend.
I completely agree. And I, you know, when I saw that West Virginia was striking again, I don't think we've seen in a while a group of teachers stand up, you know, so often and say, we're going to withhold labor until we have what we need. Right. And so they did that. They got some improvements, but this bill is incredibly important to stop. And so they were, you know, I think it's really impressive and really fantastic to see that this group of teachers learned and was able to really flex, like you said, flex that muscle of striking and realizing that when they all stand together, when we all stand together as workers, we're able to really make changes. And so they were so empowered by that first strike that they're able and willing and excited and, you know, empowered enough to do it again. Like that is, I think, really, really important. There's a couple of other teacher strikes that are going on in the nation or that will be starting. Oakland is starting on Thursday, you know, and they're striking over what's, I think, going on all around the country is rising rents are causing people to move out. And so Oakland teachers who have long lived in Oakland or who are serving the students of Oakland are on their salaries being forced out of their localities, being forced out of their housing, which, you know, it's happening nationwide, but tell us what's going on in Oakland and what teachers are expected to call for on Thursday.
Yeah, so the Oakland teachers have been really organized. We've seen this, the potential for this strike coming at least a month here. And we also saw Oakland teachers in real solidarity with the LA teachers when they were striking a few weeks ago. So, so we've seen sort of glimpses of the kind of worker power that we can expect Oakland teachers to have. They, like the LA teachers and the Denver teachers, West Virginia teachers have been in really close contact with families, communities, and students. So I expect we'll see another strike that really emphasizes the community nature of schooling and the community nature of the fight for public education in the U.S. And I think just to emphasize the housing issue, teachers being able to afford housing in the communities they teach in is not just a quality of life issue, although that should, of course, be sufficient. It's also about valuing community schooling and saying we want our teachers to live in the communities in which they teach, because these kinds of connections with parents and families are really important. You know, I was a New York City public school teacher years ago, and living in the neighborhood where I taught was crucial, right? It meant I could visit disabled parents in their homes. It meant that on my way to work, I would see kids and their parents and be able to have those kinds of conversations about what's going on with the education of their children. You get a much fuller sense of the lives of the kids you're teaching, which I will just say is even more important as we've talked about this in the segment before, right? What little social safety net there is in the U.S. Is eroding. Schools are increasingly on the front lines of all kinds of community work and social services, right? They're helping families find homes and clothing when they're homeless. They're helping recognize which kids need more access to healthy foods. They're helping families identify relationships with counselors when necessary, right? So it's as teachers' work, right, ramps up as they're responsible for all these parts of community life, it makes all that more sense, right? That the communities would be standing up with teachers and saying, yeah, the teachers are really important. School personnel, our bus drivers, right? Those people are really important to the fabric of life here, and teachers should be able to live here and have a living wage. And we should not be funneling money out of public education into for-profit approaches to education.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We're speaking with Hannah Dickinson. She's a professor and women's advocate. This is our regular Women in Society segment that airs every Tuesday. Hannah, will you tell us about some of the wins that teachers have had over the last week? There's at least two cities where there have been some really significant wins that have come about because of strikes, because of teachers standing together and saying, we need basics to continue working. We need more resources in the school system.
Yeah. So one strike that I don't think got all of the attention it should have was Chicago teachers who work with the Chicago International Charter Schools. They reached a tentative agreement after a 9-day strike. That's the second strike of charter school teachers in Chicago. And so I think And I should say what they won, which is a new contract that increases pay and decreases class sizes, right? So there again, we're seeing kind of the coupling of what teachers need to survive and what teachers need to teach successfully, right? So again, the sort of real defense of public education there, which is interesting because for so long, public school teachers working outside of right within the regular public school system and charter school teachers haven't necessarily been on the same side together. And charter school teachers haven't necessarily thought of themselves as teachers who could organize. So I think this is an important step in this much larger story about right people all over the U.S. Standing up for public education.
I absolutely agree. And I just wanted to highlight why teacher strikes, why any strike, why any labor strike, but especially these strikes we've been seeing is absolutely a women's issue, right? Like why we're talking about it on this segment is because, you know, poverty hits women first, because so many women are teachers moving around in our communities, teaching our young ones, teaching our future, because there are women on the front lines of these strikes, because women are, you know, affected by these labor struggles. And it's incredibly important to talk about this through a women's lens. So if you would highlight to in Denver, what's been going on in terms of, you know, the women's lens of this strike and these teacher strikes.
Yeah. So I wanted to read a quote from a Denver teacher who's also a strike captain, Moira Cassidos Cassidy, just because I think it so brilliantly speaks to why teacher strikes are a feminist issue. She's describing this really wonderful Valentine's Day demonstration they organized in which art teachers helped the people participating in the demo make their Valentines. The music teachers had a band that helped the group deliver their Valentines to the school district, as Cassidy says, to remind the district that teachers put so much love into our work, and it's time for the district to show some love in return. So there's a cleverness about that that I really like, but the just from a organizing standpoint. But she goes on to say, and now I'm quoting her, "The notion that teaching and other types of feminized labor, like nursing or caretaking, is a labor of love is often used to exploit us. We're expected to work nights and weekends, to spend our own money, to be there to listen and care for students and their families out of the goodness of our hearts without compensation. Parents and kids know how important that work is. That's why they've been out on the pickets and with us at rallies. But teaching's not a hobby. We're workers, and we deserve to be fairly compensated for the work that we do. Our work is valuable. Honk if you can read this as a funny sign, but it's true. Teachers are providing people with the essential skills they need to live their lives." So I just appreciated that so much, right, for the ways that I think for a really long time, and I'll say this about myself as a teacher, right? I was really young when I started teaching, and I think I kind of thought of it like, this is the way I do good in the world, or this is the way I make a difference, like almost with a kind of a charity framework. And it took a long time for me to realize that I was participating in my own exploitation by framing my work in that way, right? It's not charity to be a teacher. It's not a thing that people do only out of the goodness of their heart. They do it because it actually matters, right? It changes the future. It is a valuable thing to do, and it's work that we should value with fair wages and working conditions in which teachers can be successful.
Just because it's good for the world doesn't mean it's worth less, it's worth more, right? It's actually should be something that is paid in monetary terms, and teachers are starting to stand up and say this has to be valued in monetary terms, and it also has to be valued in monetary terms for the students, not just for our salaries, but we need resources, we need nurses in our schools, we need counselors in our schools, you know, we need computers, we need the basics, we need facilities that aren't falling apart, we need roofs that are not leaking, we need doors. My mom is a high school teacher, and she finally got a door in her public school just a couple years ago. There wasn't a door literally before, right? She's an art teacher. There weren't outlets in the walls. Like, these are basics that people need to be able to do the teaching. It's really fantastic to see people standing up. There's one more strike going on that I think we should talk about before we turn away from the labor side of women's rights and women's issues, and that's the New York nurses who are preparing to strike. What's going on in New York, Hannah?
Yeah, I think this is going to be a really interesting and important struggle to follow. So New York City nurses will take a vote on Thursday about whether they'll strike. That vote will take 10 days. So we've got some time to keep an eye on the story. But nurses were out on Wednesday from 13 different hospitals across New York City with a picket in preparation for the possibility of striking. And they're out there really focused on poor working conditions and staffing issues. So I think this issue around unsafe staffing for nurses has been like the labor issue for at least a decade. And New York City nurses are pointing to the ways in which low staffing ratios reduce the quality of care, increase mortality rates, and are dangerous to nurses and other workers in the hospitals. And so as I was learning more about this struggle, one thing I just really wanted to point to, because I found it really surprising, is, you know, I thought that there was a nursing shortage. but there have been a few studies out, including some research by the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration, that actually are projecting nursing surpluses. And they say, despite rhetoric around understaffing issues, it's actually the case that the shortage is just a reluctance on the part of hospitals and companies who want to cut their profit margins by not hiring enough staff. And so in hospitals across the country, but here we're talking specifically about New York City, nurses are dealing with staffing ratios that they are saying are unsafe for them and their patients.
One of the statistics that you were sharing before the show is one of these studies was showing that an increase in a nurse's workload by just one patient correlates to a 7% increase in the risk of mortality for that patient. I mean, that's the kind of thing we shouldn't be messing with. Just let nurses have the right ratio, especially if there's enough people you can be hiring. You know, this is, you know, money over literally everything, right? Including money over you know, increasing the likelihood someone's going to live or die.
That's right. And I, you know, one of the things that, right, sort of so irks me about this is, right, just like teachers are on the front lines of public education and understand what their students need, nurses are on the front lines of healthcare and they know what their patients need. And, you know, the Geneva Women's Assembly is organizing with some nurses in Penyan, a town just small town just next door. And one of the things I've learned from those nurses is just how frustrating it is for them to know what would increase the quality of care and, you know, to be telling hospital administrators daily about what they need and what their patients need, and to be met instead with arguments about profits, right? Saying, well, we really can't afford to hire another nurse, right? And the nurses respond, well, you know, like our coworker got a rotator cuff injury and is on disability because there wasn't enough staff here, right? So there's a kind of worker power class consciousness that gets built in these in and around these labor struggles that is in part women saying, we know what we need to do our jobs well, and we know what we need to care for our patients well. And it's time that, you know, administrators that are just looking at the profit margins start paying attention to us, because we actually are the ones with the power. You can't serve those patients if we're not showing up to work.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Hannah Dickinson. She is a professor and organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson joins us every week from Geneva, New York, and we're joined here in studio by Nicole Roussel. She's a Sputnik news analyst and producer. Moving away from the labor movement, but keeping on the topic of social movements that are being led by women, and in this case by teenage girls, there have been major demonstrations taking place primarily in Europe, but it's spreading to other countries as well, about the issue of climate change and the existential threat it poses to human society. Tell us a little bit more about these major actions that have been taking place and our plan for the future.
Yeah, if you're not following the school strike for climate movement, you should, because it's sort of one of the most inspiring things out there, I think. You know, just pictures of 10, 11, 12, 15-year-olds out in the streets in just the tens of thousands saying the adults aren't making decisions that are protecting our future. And so and the future of the planet. So, you know, we're taking charge. So it's exciting to watch. Just some background that folks may or may not know. Many of the young people are saying they were inspired by Greta Thunberg, who's now 16. She's from Sweden. And she's been boycotting school every Friday since August and has gotten a fair amount of media attention for her picketing in front of the Swedish parliament. In Belgium, for the last four Thursdays, there have been mass walkouts led by young people, and the vast majority of those leaders are young women. Last Thursday, they saw 30,000 young people across the country in Belgium. And in the U.S., students are also becoming interested in joining this movement and are planning a nationwide school strike for climate on March 15th. So I think, right, besides the fact that teenage girls are leading this movement, which is exciting, I think another piece to talk about is that these young people are recognizing that climate change is going to impact them and their futures, and also recognizing that women are more likely to be harmed by the effects of climate change, the kinds of natural disasters made more likely by global warming, that across the globe, women bear greater responsibility for accessing water, energy, and sort of other domestic life basics. And one of the things these kids are highlighting that I think is so important is that they're not part of the decision making, right? That these decisions are made mostly by men. They're certainly made by adults. And these young folks are saying, you know, by 2020, we won't even be allowed to vote yet, right? The kind of bourgeois democratic systems we're supposed to be following are clearly failing, and it's time for something else.
It's so clear to young people, I think, the profit motive isn't useful, especially not when you're talking about irrevocable, you know, climate problems. We don't, you know, a lot of these signs say we don't have a planet B, right? We don't have a plan B. We don't have a planet B. It's very true. And it's so easy when you're young to see that, right? It's very black and white. And, you know, people who, you know, grow up and go and become business majors or economics majors or get confused that like the profit motive is the only way to go, right? But it's not. And it's so much easier, I think, for kids to see that, to see, you know, what if we actually started looking to our biggest problems and trying to fix those biggest problems and not worry about how much money we're making off of it or how many billions of dollars we can continue to make until the planet dies in a massive fire, right? It's, the kids are looking forward and seeing this is going to be actually our problem and we want to fix it. And, you know, we've seen reports that say if we could use more renewables, we'd be in a better situation. We've seen, you know, reports and scientists stand up and say, well, actually, socialism is really a better, more clear alternative that will be much better for the planet and be able to start planning for what we need to do to save the planet as opposed to just planning for how much money we can make.
I'm so glad you put it that way, Nicole. There's been, you know, as you can imagine, a whole bunch of kind of condescending stuff from policymakers and in particular from politicians sort of across the globe responding to these kids. And their response, right, is if we're not going to have a future, then school doesn't matter anymore. And so there's a right as they're getting lectured about taking their schoolwork seriously. And so I think it's just what you're pointing to. There's a clear-eyed view here about what really matters. And these young folks are able to think imaginatively and think collectively and think about their own power rather than being kind of stuck in the status quo, unable to imagine another kind of future, right? They're saying we're forced to imagine apocalyptic future for ourselves. So let us be a part of the solution making and stop condescending to us and acting like we can't see what's happening here.
You know, we've got just a few minutes left here, but I want to make sure to get to this last topic. One thing you wanted to talk about today that I think is so important is that Native leaders have actually been able to brief Congress recently on reproductive health priorities. Can you tell us what's going on for Native women?
Yeah, so, right, I think it's just important to say because there are Native women in Congress, suddenly we're talking about Native women in Congress. Imagine that. Right, it points to not that Congress, the reshaping of Congress in this newest cycle fundamentally changes our system or anything, right? But it does give us a view into what would happen if we had a government that actually represented the people that live in the United States, of which Indigenous people are a really important constituency. So, Native leaders brief Congress on the real struggles that Indigenous folks are having around accessing reproductive health. And they focused on two things in particular. So one is the way the Hyde Amendment disproportionately impacts people who rely on federal funding for healthcare, right? So the Indian Health Services, which is where many Indigenous people receive their health care is 100% funded by the federal government, right? So if you're living on a reservation, you are not accessing the state funding around health care that's helping some states sort of get around the Hyde Amendment. And so these are communities that have really limited access then to reproductive health. So it's one thing. And then the other thing that I thought was really important to see was a testimony about the barriers Native women experience accessing midwifery care. And this is true for poor women across the country. If you're receiving any kind of government-funded health care through Medicare or through the Indian Health Services, you are unlikely to have any access to any kind of maternal health care, right, health care while you're pregnant, that isn't super limited. And so we have a kind of, you know, two-tiered birthing system in which wealthy women or women with access to private insurance have some choices about how they bring their children into the world, and poor and working class women don't.
That's all the time we have. We were joined by Hannah Dickinson. Hannah is a professor and an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson joined us from Geneva, New York, and we were joined in studio by Nicole Roussel and Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Today, we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst, and in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Daniel, Walter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're always happy to have you. I want to start with an article that you flagged for us that was in the Wall Street Journal that is kind of shocking to me, and it's emblematic, I think, of what's happening to our retail economy. Payless shoe stores are no more. They're being liquidated. They will cease to exist. Why is that when everybody in America needs shoes?
Yeah, this is another one of these big retail giants going down, which we've seen in the last year, such as Sears, for example, and Toys R Us would be another one. And now it's happening to Payless, which I remember going to as a kid on a regular basis to get my shoes as I was growing up. You can get cheap shoes, and your kids outgrow them so fast anyway, so you're not going to want to buy anything particularly expensive because they're just going to grind them into the ground and then outgrow them and serve that. It employs roughly 18,000 people all over the United States, and it's going to be closing about 2,100 U.S. locations. This is just a continuing process that we're seeing with regards to these brick-and-mortar retail companies being taken over by online retailers. Amazon.com probably being the biggest one, but there are a number of other shoe companies that are largely converted to online, like Zappos is another one that I can think of, and there's probably more, where, you know, the amount of human labor they need to employ to run an operation to sell shoes is significantly less than Payless shoes. And so when you can pay employees less or have less employees to pay, which is basically the same thing, you really just take their market from them entirely. You can, you know, grind down prices, you can establish monopolies over certain markets. And that's something that Amazon, amongst others, does, you know, second to none, where there's even been instances of them putting brick and mortar businesses out of business by intentionally taking a loss on competing products just to beat the other one and bankrupt them and then, you know, take over their market and raise prices again. So I'm not saying they necessarily did that with regards to Payless, but this is the shifting labor market that we're seeing now, which is happening all over the United States. Retail service sector jobs form a huge part of the U.S. economy, and those workers are really getting replaced by online e-commerce.
So it's not just Payless, Daniel. It's much, much bigger than that. We've talked about Sears. We've talked about JCPenney's. We've talked about even small retailers, mom and pop shops being driven out. And at the same time, the economy is beginning to slow, at least if housing prices are any gauge. And then that leads to a slowing at places like Home Depot and Lowe's and even Target and Walmart, because people are building fewer houses. They're buying fewer houses, and they don't need to decorate and to repair and improve those houses. There's a ripple effect, is there not?
Yeah, definitely. And I think also, if you think about it, when we talk about the economy slowing and people not making purchases at those sort of stores, being laid off from your job at Payless or Sears or one of the many other big companies is also going to affect your income, right? And so you're just going to buy the bare minimum, assuming you can even afford that, which is what we're going to start seeing. So as the economy slows, consumers are going to pull back because they got to, you know, pinch their pennies and make sure they can make it. And that in turn is going to aggravate the situation. And these companies are, especially in the retail sector, are really hard pressed to try to turn a profit. You know, you take Toys R Us, and they got really eaten up by these big e-commerce companies. They didn't pivot to a website only kind of shop front. And, you know, they basically lost the market, and they were, you know, they were an American standard. And when I was growing up, I remember everybody knew Toys R Us, and you're always super excited to go there as a kid. And that's what's happening here. So I think this is in part due to the slowdown that we're trying to see, but it's really largely a broader transformation of the labor market to where what they're doing is they're just having these heavily centralized locations, these large kind of factory-esque warehouses, where people are packing and shipping at, you know, a feverish pace. We all know about the, you know, horrible working conditions in Amazon factories. That's no surprise or no secret, I should say. That's been well publicized and well researched. And that's what we're seeing. You know, these economies of scale where everyone gets packed in these little centralized locations and pumps out as many products as possible versus a Payless where there are, you know, clerks clerks in comparatively better conditions who are going to help you look for shoes and answer questions about them and interact with you, et cetera. That sort of way of doing business is really getting destroyed by this online way of doing business where people would rather pick up their phone and press a few buttons and then, you know, get something delivered to their door in a couple of days. This is bad news for workers. You know, this spells a major challenge for them because this is some of the last vestiges of our kind of working class economy. Industrial manufacturing is gone, right? It's overseas. Nothing's going to reverse that in spite of what the current administration says. And so retail was the kind of next place. And you're seeing retail getting stripped back in the same way. So this is really significant. This is going to impact a lot of people. And as the economy slows down, it's just only going to aggravate the situation even more.
How does it work when a company as huge as, you know, for instance, Payless Shoes goes bankrupt? I mean, they had $470 million of outstanding debt. You know, what happens to the people who they owe money to? What happens to the employees? How does it work when you try to wind down, you know, such a complex entity that has property and assets and, you know, a presence in so many different cities and towns across the country?
Yeah, I mean, what happens is it becomes a major court battle, really, because what happens is there's all these creditors and debtors out there, and they want theirs. And when a corporation like Payless invokes bankruptcy law, it protects them from having to pay back a number of people, typically shareholders to a degree, but also employees. I don't know if they had a pension plan or anything like that, where they could have benefits like that. That gets put on the chopping block. But even with bankruptcy protection, the ones that really are at the front of the line for getting theirs as the company gets liquidated is the banks that issued loans. So if you are a loan issuer, you're always at the top of the heap for getting paid back. You'd much rather have a company be indebted to you than you being an investor in the company, because someone that's invested money in Payless shares or something like that is going to get lose out before banks who made loans get theirs. And of course, then at the bottom of that is typically employee benefits are paid out the least. It's a very complicated process. You have to liquidate it bit by bit, which means you have to find buyers. So are they going to buy stock in terms of shoes, you know, that have been produced? Are they going to buy retail locations that Payless actually owns? So are they going to be able to sell that property to them? And it just becomes this really messy court battle. Banks and wealthy investors have the resources to really engage in it and get representation that ensures they get every last penny. But workers, of course, do not. So that 18,000 or so people working are just going to be desperately scrambling to get a job to replace the one they lost and will not be able to represent themselves in court. So you can, you know, pretty much guess that when it comes to workers' benefits, assuming they even really had any to fight over, they're going to be losing out in the long run.
You know, I've often wondered what happens to employee benefits in the event of a bankruptcy, because you're right, it goes straight to court, it goes to the bankruptcy court, and a judge eventually decides who gets what, how many pennies on the dollar. Do you have to sell all of the equipment? Do you have to sell whatever real estate there might be? Whatever holdings the company has, it all goes away. But it's the workers generally who are hurt the most. And then, Daniel, what happens if those workers had a pension? Is the pension guaranteed by the federal government, or do they lose all of it or part of it? What happens there?
So there are federal agencies that guarantee pensions and that back them up. And typically they get involved in situations like this to ensure that they have to pay out as little as possible, that they try to lean on the company to pay out. But as you know, we saw with these recent liquidations where there was big pension plans like General Electric, his pension plan is in trouble, right? That company is doing really badly. And there's a good possibility they won't be able to pay out like they're supposed to. And they're a really old company, right? So they came from back in the day when workers expected some kind of pension plan, not like companies nowadays that almost never offer them. What happens is it can wind up in court, and the federal agencies that are responsible to kind of bail out the pension plan sometimes aren't able to. They lack sufficient resources to do it, and the company lacks resources. And so people actually end up losing portions or all of their pension, which is really interesting if you think about it, because when the banks ran out of money approximately a decade ago, there was suddenly this massive cash injection. You know, trillions of dollars suddenly appeared out of nowhere and were quickly dumped in the banks to ensure they could pay back their debts, that they could remain solvent. But then when it's workers who technically have a federal agency that's supposed to be keeping an eye on this, it's kind of in doubt, right? You know, it's, well, it's as good as the agency can do it, and we'll see what happens in court, and hopefully we can sell enough of the assets at a high enough price, versus no questions asked in 2008. The banks got their money. It wasn't even up for debate. There was no vote. And that's what happened. So it really shows, you know, the kind of power and sort of tyranny capital has over all this, because they're going to make sure that if Payless Shoe Stores took out a $100 million loan with Chase, that that's going to get paid back before any sort of benefits to employees. That being said, as I look through the article, I don't see much indicating that there was some kind of employee pension plan at Payless or anything like that. So I think they're kind of out of luck regardless. But if we look at something like General Electric, we see that what I described in action.
We're talking with Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. Daniel, there's another story you flagged for us here about home sales and home prices. What's going on there?
Yeah. So what we're seeing is a continuing slowdown in home prices. This is something that has been going on for the last couple of months. Articles keep popping up saying, ooh, it's slow again. This is reporting on data from 2018 as the year wrapped up and kind of how it looks like. And what it's showing is that home sales in December tumbled to their weakest levels since 2015. So in roughly the last 3 or 4 years, depending on how you look at it. This is significant because home sales buoy up so many different economies. It's not just the retail sector or the real estate sector. It's also construction workers and construction companies. It's also finance companies and loan companies. It's also surveyors, people who are involved in, you know, housing inspections and things like that. There's all these downstream effects and all these other groups that are impacted by a slow in home prices. I think I used automobiles previously as a way of saying there's so many different groups and companies that come together to produce a single automobile that produce different parts and aspects of it and assemble it. Same idea with retail. This is really, you know, significant because what we keep seeing in these, you know, Wall Street Journal types is a discussion about how the economy in 2019 is slowing. And that's largely due to a number of factors. One of them is, you know, we've had a boom cycle ever since 2008 where things have gone up and up and up. Boom cycles have to end. They have to go down. If it started going down now, it'd be one of the longest consistent boom cycles that we've ever seen. But also, you know, the trade war is causing a lot of instability in China. Economists and investors don't know exactly what's going to happen next or how this administration is going to handle it. It could be disastrous. It might not be. And so all these sort of uncertainties, and especially in geopolitics, are causing this sort of downturn. And the housing sales is part of that, where it's both an aggravating factor that causes it to increase and also a symptom of it, that there's a slowdown in this. So, you know, we remember what 2008 is, and it certainly doesn't seem like it'll be quite that dramatic because there's been enough regulation in the meantime to kind of keep the same, you know, horrific disaster of 2008 from happening. But it is a really important indicator because that means there'll be a number of people not being able to find employment in the kind of the real estate sector the way they used to. And it'll continue that slowdown.
You know, I'm wondering too, Daniel, if you can explain something about the strength or the weakness maybe of the economy. The president touts the economy as the strongest in the world, which of course it's not, as the strongest in American history, which of course it's not. But it's still a decent economy. There's some growth. Inflation is generally low and interest rates remain low. So what are we looking at here? Are we looking at a cyclical slowdown, or are we looking at something that's been imposed because of the trade war with the Chinese? If it's the latter, when the economy comes out of this, what happens then to interest rates and housing starts and inflation and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, every administration is going to talk about it did wonderful things for the economy. It doesn't matter who it is, whether that's true or not. And that's just campaign rhetoric, and you've got to get used to it. I agree. You know, the United States economy, in spite of its recent troubles, still remains, you know, overall, comparatively to most economies, massive. I think what we're seeing right now, though, is a divergence, because what has sort of been the gospel truth historically is that if the stock market is doing well, in other words, if the guys at the top are doing well and making money, then that's just the economy, quote unquote, is good. And that just trickles down to everyone. And while economics have largely been discredited, there is some truth to it in that workers in really abundant profit creating markets, generally speaking, sometimes see benefits from that and see an increase. But what we've seen over the last 30 years is a real divergence between corporations continually beating their records every quarter and making more and more profits than before, and worker wages remaining stagnant. So a lot of these economists point to things like the stock market or like all these big instances of, you know, capital formation with these large corporations and say, oh, look, it's going up. You know, there's all this profit. But then if you turn and look in the other direction, what you're seeing is, boy, it doesn't seem to be affecting anyone except for these very small group of investors. And I think what we're seeing is people like the Wall Street Journal and others bending over backwards to try and explain that and trying to somehow justify that, oh, no, they need to keep making their profit. That's not the problem. There's other problems that are somehow preventing it from trickling down to you. So I think what we're seeing now as we kind of enter this next phase of capitalism in the 21st century is that the traditional markers of what indicates a healthy economy or a good economy or strong economy are becoming less and less reliable and more divergent from what average everyday working people experience, to where a quote good strong economy does not equal a good strong job, and a bad economy equals an even worse job. And so I think that we're going to see this continual slowdown, which is not necessarily going to be reflected in the stock market and, you know, prices bouncing around, but is going to be more and more reflected in just the overall society we're in terms of people being unable to make a decent wage and keep a roof over their head.
Why is housing so crucial to the economy in the United States? I mean, there's, of course, you know, the essential character of housing in general. But, you know, housing is a commodity in the United States, and it's sort of particularly strategically located in the overall, you know, structure of the economy, so that, you know, if it's particularly vulnerable, or, you know, it has the ability to sort of ripple out with particular speed and intensity. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah. So, I mean, housing is a necessity, right? It's like food or water. It's not a luxury. You can't go without it the way you could go out without fine jewelry or something like that. Everyone's got to have it. So it's something that everyone needs access to desperately. Secondarily, it's influenced by so many other economies. So the construction industry, but then the retail stores like Home Depot that sell the materials to the construction industry. And then the factories and processing plants that create the materials, which they sell to Home Depot so they can sell to the construction industry, like companies that create paint or companies that create plastics or companies that create all wiring, all these things necessary to a house. And all those companies are, of course, staffed with large numbers of workers who are producing these things. Then there's the finance sector. And the finance sector likes to gamble on this stuff, right? They're not buying houses to live in. The CEO of JP Morgan Chase doesn't invest billions of dollars in real estate because he needs billions of dollars of homes to live in. They do it to speculate on it. They want to buy low. They want to sell high. So that distorts and aggravates prices, which means that the prices of homes, as they shift and change, as companies over, or I should say, as banks overestimate how profitable things will be or underestimate, causes a ripple effect where banks then can lose significant amounts of money. And banks are such a huge cog in this big machine that we call global capitalism, that when they start to fail, it influences many other things. So really, housing is so connected to us as human beings at a basic level, right? From primitive times, we needed something to live in, whether it was a cave or what have you. And that's no different today in terms of that fundamental need that every single human being is going to have, causes so many parts of the economy to be tied to it as a necessary way of creating it. And on top of that, is further aggravated by the finance sector creating these bubbles by speculating on it. So that's why a lot of times these economic journals like the Wall Street Journal will point to housing sales as a broader indication of the economy. And most of the time, they're correct. Most of the time, it reflects the broader economy accurately.
You also flagged, Daniel, a piece for us from the Washington Post about a $300 billion with a B dollar business tax break that was supposed to be used to raise wages. Instead, it was helping companies replace workers with machines. What's that all about?
So I'm glad we brought this one up because this is important. So one of the things that a tax bill in 2002 was passed. So in 2002, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act allowed corporations to write off the depreciation of their machines. So what the heck does that mean? That basically means that a corporation is allowed to write off the wear and tear on its machines every year as a tax break. So it says, well, my machines have dropped $10,000 in value, let's say, so I'm going to write that off on my taxes and essentially get it paid for by the government rather than paying for it myself. And what they're supposed to do is do this over a slow, extended period of time as the machines slowly break down and eventually need to be replaced. But this tax act allowed them to do that write-off all at once. all at the beginning. So rather than waiting for the machines to slowly break down over, say, 6 years, 10 years, it allowed them to write off the machine in the first year, which is insane. So if you bought a $100,000 tractor, let's say, you could write it off that same year for the full $100,000, which is basically to say the government bought you a tractor, is really what it comes down to, and more specifically, taxpayers bought you a tractor. This was touted, of course, as a way for corporations to invest more capital and, of course, produce jobs, right? The end result is somehow this is going to produce jobs. But what it did instead is, see, corporations will replace workers with machines, but only if it saves them money. And a lot of times those machines are very expensive and it's hard to know how well they'll work and how long they'll run. So corporations sometimes stick with workers because it's a cheaper form of labor. So even though they could make things more efficient, it would be more expensive. And so they don't want to do that. But this tax break allowed them to get all this machinery for free, right? They don't get a tax break for hiring workers. They only get a tax break for implementing machines. So what this has caused is this ripple effect over the last 15 years of all these corporations saying, well, heck, I'm going to buy all these machines. Normally it would be cost prohibitive, but I'm going to get this big tax break. So I'm going to do it. So what this essentially means is taxpayer dollars are being given to corporations so that they can produce automation to put us out of jobs. So we're essentially paying for them to take away our jobs, which is what this report done by Duke and Grinnell Universities identified. So it's actually really kind of goes back to what we talked about before about automation and e-commerce really replacing workers. And this is just aggravating it. These tax breaks are just making it even worse.
So it's not China, in other words. It's not, you know, sort of a foreign adversary that's, you know, tailoring its economy so that the workers in the United States are just screwed. It's really sort of this long-term trend that's been present, I mean, since the beginning of human civilization, you know, where the tools, right, the means of production writ large, develop over time. And, you know, that makes human labor more effective.
Yeah. And it's not China, right? This is all being done mostly to sell to domestic markets, although certainly we sell to China as well. There's a market there that's significant and shouldn't be looked down on. But no, it's not China that's automating everything. We gave a huge tax break to our businesses in 2002 so that they can continue to automate things. China didn't do that. China had nothing to do with the process. We did. And the very wealthy, you know, Congress people who were in charge, who oversaw that process, were the ones that did it. So, you know, we could identify them as the real problem. But I think on a larger level, we have to think about technology and automation. It's marching forward, right? And scientific discovery and technological advancement are incredible things. They're amazing, right? They're why, you know, we don't have a life expectancy of 30 years and something like a sinus infection doesn't drop us dead. We can survive. So technology is wonderful and can do amazing things. But when it's put in the hands of a very small group of people whose sole motive for using that technology is to create profit, it creates chaos, it creates misery, and it creates people that can't have jobs that exist in an economy that has no place for them. And so the real question isn't so much that, you know, is technology bad? Or should we roll these things back? Certainly not. The question is who owns the technology and how we use it? Do workers own the technology to improve their own lives, to make things better for everyone? Or do corporations own it so that they can maximize every single drop of profit? And that's a moral question that we need to answer as a society that needs to be addressed.
I want to talk just for another couple of minutes about this tax break issue. There was a piece in the Washington Post about Google and Google's real estate holdings. It was entitled, Google Reaped Millions in Tax Breaks as it secretly expanded its real estate footprint across the U.S. I wasn't aware that Google was buying real estate across the U.S. until I read this article. Can you talk about that and exactly what tax breaks and how much money are we talking about here?
Yeah. So this is a really interesting process. So Google knows how unpopular its data centers and its operations are in certain communities. I mean, we've seen the outcry of the residents of Queens, New York against Amazon's new headquarters there. And, you know, it actually worked. It pushed Bezos out, or at least so far it seems to have. So these people in Queens can continue to have a decent and affordable life. I mean, as much as one can in New York City, which is, you know, wildly expensive. But, you know, you can see people are not excited about these tech giants coming to their communities. This isn't something they want. Google knows that. So when Google needs to open up data centers, it does a lot of secret kind of backroom deals. It does a lot of purchasing of real estate by shell companies. So it talks about in the article, there was a company called Sharka LLC, which was actually Google, but they created this shell company called Sharka LLC, which was wholly owned by Google. And Sharka would go around purchasing the real estate. And so when you looked at public records, it wouldn't immediately become obvious that Google was purchasing things in those areas. Secondarily, they got complicity from local government, right, who was willing to keep quiet about the business dealings. and who are willing to pass along tax breaks without discussing it. And of course, this is exactly what Google wants, right? They want to be able to open up their operations one day where the residents of the community just step outside and suddenly there's a giant Google warehouse there. And there's no opportunity to debate, to discuss, to vote, to have any sort of democratic control over their land there. And just that Google can just come in and open up shop, which is exactly what we see. So what they have trouble in the article estimating exactly how much these huge tax breaks are, because a lot of it is very off the books, and it's to these companies that are Google but aren't called Google. It's sort of like almost intentional obscuring of one's identity. But it's estimated, given the large amounts of them, that there are hundreds of millions, if not potentially billions, in tax breaks, because they're all over the United States. It has this map where it, you know, noted we're looking at Iowa, California, Oregon, Texas, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, all over the place, these sprawling data centers. And so it's really interesting to see how aware these companies are of how much these communities don't want them there, how negative their presence is to those communities, and also how far they're willing to go to keep their identity secret and to keep it out of the hands of the communities, what happens to their land in the hands of Amazon or Google. So that's really what we're seeing here.
The fact that they felt the need to do this, that Google felt the need to set up all these shell companies to sort of hide what they're actually doing, the fact that they're moving into these different communities. I mean, I think it reveals a pretty interesting political trend, right? I mean, that there's so much more consciousness around the role of big corporations, inequality, how these big tech monopolies are sort of the embodiment of inequality in a lot of places. I mean, it's pretty interesting. It really shows that there's a shift in public consciousness, because I think before, you know, say maybe like 10 years ago or more like 15 years ago before the recession, you know, a lot of politicians would be sort of like trumpeting the arrival of these corporations like Google. But now, not so much.
Yeah, well, at the risk of making a bad pun, the shine is definitely off the apple. And once upon a time, these companies kind of were able to posture themselves as like, oh, we're just these like clever little wacky techno kids in our garage, like producing the next big thing. And wouldn't it be cool if we were in your neighborhood, you know, producing little drones or light up machines or things like that. And now, you know, what we've seen is that there are these massive corporations that have reached fingers into every single aspect of our lives. Everyone has a smartphone. Everybody uses Google and essentially is forced to give away their data to them. And it does show a shift in consciousness where people are realizing, oh, these corporations are just as bad as Halliburton or Raytheon or any of the other big ones, and that they're about as interested in our well-being as those other companies are as well. So yeah, we're seeing that huge shift. People don't see them as these kind of benign, funky entrepreneurs that are just thinking of the next big thing. They recognize them for what they are, which are giant profit-seeking machines whose job is primarily to enrich themselves at the expenses of the communities that they operate in.
That's all the time we have. We were joined by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. He joined us from San Francisco. And we were joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, a Sputnik News analyst. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.